Welcome to the Good Doctrine Podcast, where we believe that good doctrine establishes good living. I'm Sean Pasley.
And I'm Josh Howard. We're on episode of Good Doctrine Podcast. Sean, what episode are we even on?
131.
Thank you, Sean. 131 of Good Doctrine Podcast. How you doing, Sean? How's France? How's it's snowing here in Michigan. How are you doing over there across the pond?
It's good. It's not snowing. It is beautiful. And we have flowers in our garden of the house that we rent that the former people who lived here planted, and we are reaping the benefits. It's just, it's lovely. Trying to think, anything else special going on? Oh, yeah.
So you're just sitting back and letting these flowers die? You're not even tending them or anything?
No, I'm tending them well enough, but they're still alive. But with all the, I was thinking, you know, what's been happening here in France that the rest of the world might know about? And then I thought, oh, yeah, the endless protests that have been happening, which don't really affect the fiery garbage heaps in my city. I mean, obviously, you know, what most people think about when they think about France is Paris. And so there are definitely fiery garbage heaps there. But this city is just like inconveniences of, you know, and hours long traffic jams with the protests and stuff. So we are now a bike everywhere family, which is a blessing living in Europe. You can do that here. So we bought bikes, and now we do that in order to, you know, bypass the blocking the highways that the protesters like to do.
You know, I've got to at least say, like, when I see these, you know, these garbage fires, as you describe them, you know, in France, at least, like, I see a people that care, Sean. You know, I see people that are engaged. They care about the issues. They're willing to get out and burn some trash heaps. And that, I mean, it's not great. It's not great, but it's not terrible. You know, at least they're involved. So that's good.
Yeah. Yeah. There's
nothing worse than apathy. Am I right?
Are you trying to do a really super smooth transition into the topic of the day?
Trying.
Okay.
Trying a little bit, John. Yeah, yeah. This is really hard,
but
we haven't done it in a month.
It is true. It is true that people here are very involved in their government and their governance. So, you know, and the things regarding the nation. So,
hey, speaking of nations and governances, Sean, how about this Christian nationalism thing? So you're not on Twitter. And I suspect, you know what? I don't know if all of our followers, I know most of my church, I doubt I could probably name on, like, I could count on one hand the number of people in my church that are on Twitter. It's just, something that a lot of people avoid, but I know a lot of pastors on Twitter, which is interesting. It's an interesting dynamic. Not a lot of church folk on Twitter, but a lot of pastors on Twitter. In any case, it's been a pretty hot topic of debate and vitriolic debate at times. Christian nationalism, which a lot of people may not even know what we're talking about.
Yeah. I was going to say about the topic. I have the tendency when I hear like these labels, when I hear, you know, so, and we name our podcast these labels like theonomy or preterism or whatever. When I hear these labels, sometimes I have a tendency to go, oh, goodness, you know, how is that for me? I don't know what they're talking about. But like we try to do every single episode, we try to show how, while you might not know the name of this particular thing, you know, that we are elucidating this episode, you definitely feel its effects. And this is something, the idea of, excuse me, Christian nationalism is something that's been really, really hot. And you said, you know, you have a bunch of pastors, friends that you know on Twitter. Well, if you don't know the word Christian nationalism or the phrase Christian nationalism, it's more than likely that your pastor does, because in the kind of Christian blogosphere, in kind of Christian life right now, it's people are writing a lot of books about it, either for or against it. There are entire conferences where, you know, multi-day conferences, probably near a lot of people that we're talking to.
They're having one right now. Right Response Ministries is having one in Texas titled Theonomy and Christian Nationalism.
Okay.
Founders Ministries in Florida, yes, they just did one on Christian nationalism. But I'd also, let me point out, Sean, as you're continuing, though, because I don't want to cut you off, but as people are hearing this, what I don't want you to think, and I'm going to try to convince you of this in this episode, it's not something that doesn't impact the Christian that's not on Twitter. So in other words, like, I do not think this issue, sometimes there's stuff that flares up on Twitter and you're like, well, this is just meaningless dribble. This is just people, you know, venting about things. I don't think it's that. I do think this actually impacts, even even if you've never heard the topic, I don't think it's one of those things that like, oh, that's something esoteric that, that theologians are arguing about. I don't think that's this.
Yes, I agree with you on that point. You know, for example, we've never done an episode on like theistic evolution, but that's kind of one of those things that was a real hot topic in academia a few years ago. And, you know, it probably still is. There are probably still people talking about it, but there was like a big juicy book written about it and, you know, whole conferences and what was it? ETS. That was,
I sat in on the book presentation at ETS when they presented that one.
Yeah. And you know, so it's kind of, we don't have to go into that one, but that's sort of like a lofty topic that may or may not affect you in your local church level, depending on how engaged your pastor is. But I think as someone who lives in a nation, which is 100%, because I look at the stats of the podcast, 100% of the people who listen to this podcast live in an identifiable nation, the idea of Christian nationalism is pertinent to you. And
wait a minute. Did we lose that? Didn't we have a listener that was in a... like Antarctica or something? Didn't we like catch one of the scientists that was at one of those remote stations?
I think that's the only one.
No, he dropped off and is not listening anymore. Maybe not. We've got to get him back.
But either way, I think those labs in Antarctica are still affiliated with some, you know, some nation
some
somewhere.
Nation state, yeah.
Yeah. But everyone is under some sort of governmental rule. Everyone on Earth is, and you know, how tight or how loose that governmental rule is not really the point. You know, Christian nationalism addresses it all. But I will say that this is a topic that you're definitely going to have to take center stage on. And I do want to obviously interact with you a lot about it, a lot on it. But what has been mostly in the ether is American Christian nationalism. And obviously, as someone who lives in Western Europe and in the most secular country, probably I think most people think that France is like the most secular country in the world, if not, you know, if not the most, it's definitely one of the top three, you know, not counting the former Soviet countries. But it's definitely a topic that interacts, or that I interact with, a lot differently than people who are living in the States do. So
right, and it's also kind of unfortunate because a lot of people, you know, just saying the words Christian nationalist, they're politically charged words, right? Mm. Like, so for a while, being a nationalist was kind of a polemical term that was used primarily by the left toward those on the right in politics. And they'd say, oh, you're a nationalist, as, you know, kind of with the echoes of, you know, pre-World War II nationalism, right? And those sort of movements. But also, Christian nationalist is often combined with the term white. So oftentimes, especially in American news networks right now, you'll hear the term white Christian nationalist, which is obviously a negative. And I bring that up just to say, like, it makes these terms very difficult to nail down exactly what you're talking about. Because if you were to ask people, and in fact, I just saw somebody do this, they asked, you know, what is Christian nationalism? And you know, almost as many people as responded had a different definition. You know,
right,
most of them are
right,
in the same general neighborhood, but always a little bit of nuance there.
Well, it's definitely a topic that's involved in, you know, we've talked about intersectionality before, but like the nomenclature white Christian nationalist, if you or I is pinned down as a white Christian nationalist, that means that we, you know, we are one of the privileged elite. It has that, you know, that, like you said, that kind of politically charged language surrounding it.
Oh, yeah.
Where it stops losing its actual like theological sense, because there is theology, which is, that's what we want to talk about. Good doctrine. There is a theology behind the idea of Christian nationalism and theonomy. So, and you know, you just mentioned that the definitions, depending on who you ask, are wide and varied, but In the case of this podcast today, what exactly are we talking about when you say Christian nationalism and theonomy?
Yeah, and those are going to be two different questions.
Yes.
So I'll talk about Christian nationalism first, and then here in a second, maybe we can talk about you know, theonomy and theocracy. And I'm not going to lie, Sean, I hate to distract from the podcast, but it is a straight blizzard outside my window. And it's almost May, and this is super distracting for me. It is belting down snow outside my window right now. This is hilarious to me.
Enjoy it.
Okay, so back to Christian nationalism. Nobody cares about the snow in Michigan. So back to Christian nationalism. So Christian nationalism, and again, depending on who you ask, but it's asking the question, can you have something that can be a Christian nation? So most of us would say you can have a Christian individual. Many of us would say you can have something like a Christian family. can you have something that is called a Christian nation? That's not to say that every single member of that nation is regenerate, nor is it to say every single member of that nation is following God or even obeying his laws. But can you say, on the whole, a nation could be described as Christian? That's the question that kind of underlies Christian nationalism. Now, there's a lot of different approaches to that topic, how the law should be addressed, how that nation should not only accept God's law, but apply God's law and enforce God's law. Should the governance be big? Should it be small? Should it be tied to the church? Should it be separate from the church? Should it advocate for some sort of pluralistic society as far as religious liberties go? Or should there be a kind of religion that is advocated, you know, specifically Christianity within Christian nationalism? So you've got a lot of different guys writing on that. You had the recent book that came out through Canon Press by Wolf called The Case for Christian Nationalism.
Right.
That was one specific case for something called a Christian nation. Doug Wilson, who's also writing through Canon Press, he just came out with is coming out with a book called Mere Christianity, which is another approach to this question. I've seen Tymon Klein
it's called Mere Christianity.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, Mere Christendom.
Oh, okay.
Excuse me, Mere Christendom. Thanks for the catch on that. But yeah, it's answering the question then of, can you have some form of Christendom or a reflection and identification of Christianity within the political sphere? And I'm going to point out, like, just at the outset of that question, because you and I have often talked about this, Sean, it really matters where you're coming from, the way people hear these things, right? So you're in France, people hear things differently. I've learned that in our own church context, depending on where somebody's coming from, they can hear these things very differently. If you're coming from a context within which the church and state lines have been blurred significantly, and I'm thinking specifically with like Roman Catholicism and the way it interacted and still to an extent interacts in some South American contexts and things like that, you might hear this question very differently.
Mm-hmm.
If you're coming from the American South and you're used to hearing maybe fundamentalist, and I don't mean that, you know, vitriolically, but like preachers on the fundamentalist side of things that may you know, they come in every year and they give you your voting card that tells you all the candidates that you're commanded to vote for from that church and stuff. We may hear something like that and think, oh, okay, that's a blending then of church state. It really matters what you're hearing when somebody talks about Christian nationalism, but really at the core of it, I think, is, can you have something that can be described aptly as a Christian nation? And then past that, does the nation, in any nation, it's not just America, but does a nation state and must a nation state submit to God's law? And what does that look like?
Mm.
To me, those are some of the questions that are kind of swirling within that. Should governments obey God's law? Should they enforce God's law? And what are the parameters and extents to which that occurs?
And just to jump in, the reason why this would matter to you, individual person listening to this, you know, you might not be a politician or a pastor, or you might, you know, not even think that you yourself are interested in just theological topics like this. But when someone says, why can't I have an abortion? I don't believe the Bible. I don't believe because, you know, you'll have people who stand outside of abortion clinics and they'll say to people going to have an abortion, you know, they'll hold up Bible verses or say, you know, that God has created this baby. And so someone will refute that with, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in what the Bible says. So why do your laws,
keep your religion out of my bedroom.
Yeah. That kind of thing. You know, it's the same thing with homosexuality and transgenderism. You know, a lot of Christians argue at people from the perspective of God says this is wrong, and they will in turn get a, well, I don't believe in your God, so why does it affect me in any way? And I think that this topic kind of intersects, you know, with those questions. And these are questions that everyone has to answer.
And I think a good reason for that, because a lot of people have been wondering, like, why are we even having a conversation about Christian nationalism, theonomy, theocracy, all these things? Why are we even talking about this? America, you know, just speaking candidly, America seems to be spiraling unless God in his grace decides to stop the current progress. America seems to be spiraling, and it seems like God's judgment is falling on our nation and on our Western culture. That seems to be the current state of things. So a lot of people have wondered, like, what is the point of even talking about a Christian nation? Is this not us wasting our time? Because I don't think there's, you know, unless there's just mass revival or the winds of God blow through our government, I don't think there's going to be a huge sea change in that regard. But that's the whole point of this conversation, is looking at a culture that at one point, for better or worse, there was plenty of flaws, there was plenty of warts, but a culture at one point that was sending more missionaries into the world than had ever been sent in human history, that was proclaiming God's law, where you saw the Ten Commandments. And again, whether you think that was a good thing or not, but the Ten Commandments were in front of courthouses. Like, there was a clear Christian influence that was in this country. And it's worthwhile for us to consider not only A, why did it go wrong, but B, what do we build in the aftermath? What are we aiming for as Christians? And that's why I said at the beginning that this is not just some sort of esoteric or, you know, some sort of wasting our time conversation. No, this is us looking around and saying, things do seem to be crumbling. Why'd they crumble, and what do we want to build in their place?
Mm.
But thinking back then to the question, I think we could frame it like this, because for a lot of Christians, This is the way I'm thinking through this, and there's always going to be a lot of holes in these sort of conversations, but just bear with me. So if you think of something like transgenderism, that's one of the hot topics right now. You're having countless stories of, especially within school contexts, of transgendered athletes and people in locker rooms and all these sort of things. But if you think of transgenderism, should people dress and portray themselves as the opposite gender that they are? So God hath made them male and female. Should they do something that is contrary to God's design? That would be a question for the Christian. And as you're considering that, you may struggle a bit and say, well, I don't want to seem judgmental, or I don't want to, you know, intrude into others' lives. But at the end of the day, no, I do think that, yes, maybe I should, I can confess that, yes, God does have a perfect law, that sin is destructive, and that I should speak with a prophetic voice toward these matters. So yes, I will make a stance on that. And then you push it a little farther and say, well, should there be a law to prevent such things?
Before we get into that, into the legislation, I do want to kind of, maybe there's a step that was skipped over, because I think there are some people who would say, yes and amen, it's a sin. So transgenderism is a sin because it's a denial of the, you know, how God has created us. And it's, you know, it's a disagreement and a flaunting, you know, of our disagreement with Scripture. I personally believe that. But then you kind of threw in the prophetic voice, like, do we speak against it? Do we speak in public against it? And I think for a lot of people, that's a bigger step than the next step.
Right. So okay, and I'm glad you slowed me down on that. So if you were to look in biblical context, does God bring disaster for sin, not just on individuals but on nations?
Yes.
Does God bring it on peoples? Do we ever see in Scripture where God's people, whether Israel in the Old Testament or the church in the New Testament, do we ever see a time in which God's people do not speak to the sin in their own culture, and they incur judgment for that? I can think of many examples from, like, the book of Isaiah might be a clear example. Yes. Where God's people are visited covenant judgment from God specifically because they kept their mouths shut and said, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Mm. So when we look at those type of things, I think we could easily say God's people can't be silent. And for a long time, there's been, and you and I have talked about this, Sean, like, there's been the Christian, you know, it's kind of the 11th commandment, thou shalt be nice. We have made such an idol of being well-liked, not well thought of, but well-liked by the culture around us, that anything that would offend somebody, we regard as sin, when I would push back and say, no, to not offend a sinful culture with the truth of God, that is sin, and that's something we will incur judgment for.
Okay.
That's one that I think that Christians would do well to consider those things. What is the role of God's people in any given culture? And to me, that's not just an Old Testament or a New Testament example. I think that's one that's consistent throughout Scripture. We are called to proclaim light in darkness, truth amidst untruth. And when we fail to do so, Israel would be a really clear referent. But also in the New Testament, we're called, like, you know, Christ is walking among the lampstands and he's saying, you've forgotten your first love. You've ceased proclaiming my truth amidst a culture that I've commanded you to do so. that's an area of covenant obedience for the Christian church that I think we've really laxed in over the years. But I'm glad you brought it up, though, because I do think a lot of Christians struggle with that voice.
Yeah, and this isn't necessarily to say that every person needs to be a street preacher and, you know, proclaiming the downfall of Western society in public. But I do, I really do wholeheartedly believe that more Christians than not, at least in our Western culture context, definitely here in Western Europe, but more Christians than not keep their faith as a personal thing. So whatever their beliefs about, you know, their particular beliefs about what is right, what is wrong, what is sin, and what is good and profitable for mankind, I think the bigger step is them voicing that truth.
Yeah, and good grief. I'm so glad you brought that up because Sean, you and I have talked a lot about our different contexts, so I won't belabor that point. But like there's a lot to be said for the how, right?
Mm.
We can talk about the how. Like, is it profitable and effective for me to go and do sidewalk ministry with a bullhorn, for example? Sometimes the answer may be yes. Sometimes the answer may be no. Like, is it profitable for me to write letters to those who are in positions of power in my government? Sometimes yes. Sometimes no. Like, so we can talk about the how, but we can't argue over the impetus behind that. We are called to do it. That's the what, and then the how leads from that. I feel that for a lot of Christians, we get hung up on the how and we kind of forget about the what, but we can never sacrifice the fact that we are called to do that. Then we can figure out the how and what to say. Mm. I just lost my train of thought, but yeah, for a lot of Christians in today's age, I think that to me, I mean, I don't mean to always go back to the Dietrich Bonhoeffer illustration, but like when you think to World War II Germany and you see, there was Christians in the church in Germany, and they're having a radical sea change, a social, political, ideological, religious sea change that's all around them. Nazism is taking force, and we look back now and we see kind of the whole scope of it. But to them, it kind of seemed, I would imagine, the same way as we look around now and we see our culture is radically different than it was 3 years ago, and we wonder, well, how did that happen so quickly? Mm. So they're seeing these things happen, and before long, you're seeing rail cars full of Jews going through your backyards on the way to gas chambers. And the church was silent in many regards. And that's where Dietrich Bonhoeffer comes out. And, you know, there's this huge reaction against the silence of the quote unquote Christian church. We look back now with the gift of hindsight and we say, well, they should have said something. Now you could go back into that context and walk through all the individual stories and all the various factors that were playing on people. You can argue, like, when should they have said something? How should they have said something? How could one possibly speak to power when you're talking about Nazism and you're talking about, you know, the draconian state that was enforced there? How would one possibly stand up for those sort of things? None of us would disagree, though. They had to say something sometime.
Mm.
There was a point at which Christians had to stand and probably keep standing and stand at their own expense. We all look back now and say, yes, that was a failure of the German church in the years leading up to World War II, that they did not stand. The how is the afterthought. That's just the pragmatism of the situation. How then do we stand? That's fine. Let's have that conversation. But that you should stand is something that you have to kind of establish at the front end.
Okay, good. Well, that's your arguments, you know, not just the 1930s and 40s Germany argument, but the scriptural arguments all present a very good case for why Christians must take that step of public proclamation against sin and depravity in the world. But then, you know, you were moving into, when I rudely interrupted you, you were moving into the idea of legislation then of these principles, you know, how do we do that?
Man, the legislation part is, it gets so convoluted. And for a lot of us, like, you know, I used to, you know, famously say that, like, you know, I don't want anybody to know my politics and I don't want to talk about politics. And to a certain extent, I still agree with that statement, but we're not talking about politics with these things. It's just, how do we want, well, number one, what law, or no, let me put it this way. How do we want the government to legislate morality? And what morality do we want it to legislate?
Yeah. So you didn't say should they, you said how should they and which morality. Yeah. So you have to explain that.
I'm saying that because obviously, you know, number one on the front end, you know, a lot of times we say like the government shouldn't legislate morality. Mm. That is one of the most misguided things to say. Of course, the government legislates morality and I'm grateful they do. We have laws against murder. I'm grateful that we have laws against murder. I don't want people murdering my family members with impunity, right? That is a moral judgment. And if you look back in our country's history, we don't murder one another. Excuse me. We don't have laws against murdering one another because it's bad for the social, social value, or like we can't have as much economic output if people are murdering. No. We don't murder one another because we said it's wrong. Hmm. It's a moral judgment. It is wrong and evil to murder someone else. And we get that based on Christian values, based on scripture. So number one, government legislates morality. And if you look in, like, for example, Romans 12, and it lays out those roles of the government, then we see that the government is the deacon of God. It is the legislator of morality. It's there to punish good and to reward,
yes, that opposite.
Was a Freudian slip, punish evil and reward good. So, that's the function then of the government. So number one, they're going to legislate morality, but then the follow-up question becomes, what morality are they going to legislate? Mm. This is where I think Christian thinking should come in, because this isn't a big government, small government conversation. We can lead into that, and we can talk about why I think small government is biblical and why we have a bloated large government that is not in keeping with biblical standards. But just for the moment, let's just recognize that when the government has laws against murder, that is legislating morality. And we as Christians say it's good that we have laws against murder, not because I don't want my family members murdered, although I don't. It's good because it's enforcing what God says, which is thou shalt not murder. Genesis 9, this is part of God's covenant with the world, is that thou shalt not murder, and that those who do murder shall be punished in like kind. So it's legislated based on the law, word of God. So then if we apply that a little bit further, if it's not God's law word, what will we then legislate morality based on? Because we will inevitably legislate morality. And if you're wondering, like, well, what's a good test case for that? We're seeing laws passed right now, for example, that say if I stand behind a pulpit, and it hasn't been applied it hadn't been applied to this extent in our state yet, but it has been applied within driving distance of me. So this kind of hits close to home. If I stand behind a pulpit and I say God has made them male and female, to depart from God's creational design is not only sin, but it's destructive to the one that is made in his image and worthy of honor and respect. And we as a Christian church want to encourage you in the creational order that God has made you in, and encourage you to follow that paradigm that God has set forth for you, and the kind of the teleology of your creational design. If I say that from behind pulpits within driving distance of me, that has now been labeled hate speech,
right?
And can carry even up to a jail fine. When we see that as Christians, oftentimes we just say, oh, the world's going to pot. You know, people are making bad decisions. No. Just recognize what's happening. They are legislating morality. That is a legislation of morality. Why are there hate crime statutes being passed in speaking against the LGBTQ agenda? It's because it is a legislation of morality. The question is not whether they're going to legislate morality, because every culture throughout human history has always and inevitably legislated morality to a greater or lesser extent. Mm-hmm. The whole question is, whose morality? Will it be God's or will it be the devil's? Mm. That is the whole question that we're looking at here. And that's the...
Because, you know, you put this kind of extreme example of hate speech, of plain Christian teaching, plenary Christian, you know, teaching. I mean, understandable to everyone who opens a Bible and reads these pages. This is now qualified in some instances as hate speech. It's been qualified as hate speech in France for a while. But something a little bit more neutral, you know, most people, you didn't talk about how... You talked about how the Christian church and Christian teaching has influenced legislation in that, you know, thou shalt not murder, equaling we can't kill everybody we want to. Too bad. But that's just a joke. Please don't, you know, whatever. I'm going to have to edit that out. I don't know if I'll be allowed. That's hate speech.
We're out on YouTube with this podcast.
Yeah. Well, what I was saying is, you know, you've kind of taken it from one angle, but I've noticed here in Western Europe, because it's a new context for me, a relatively new context for me, that legislation or morality goes the other way too, in that certain things have become moral or immoral or amoral based on legislation. So a topic that's relatively, to the American mind, probably neutral. I mean, it's very highly politicized, but, you know, both sides of politics can recycle. you know, you can be a staunch conservative Republican. You know, you could love your Fox News and you know, wear your MAGA hat, and you can still recycle because you value ecology and you value, you know, taking care of the earth in that way. Or, you know, you buy an electric car because you think that that's going to help the economy. You don't have to be like a hippie Colorado weed shop owner to own an electric car and recycle. But in Western Europe, it is fascinating to me how in the church, within the churches, it's viewed almost as a moral good to be ecologically minded. Christians must be ecologically minded if you want to be a good, moral, upstanding citizen, and in, you know, in accordance with God's laws for stewardship of His creation, then you must be, you know, you must recycle, you must, you know, conserve, and you must think about these things. And it seems to be, it seems to stem from, not from Christian teaching, because, you know, I mean, it's absent, or at the very best, it's kind of vaguely inferred that it's important that we, you know, protect the environment. But in here in France, Christians are very serious about it, to the point where it almost seems like it's like, but like I said, it seems like it came from the other side, where it came from government regulation and legislation first that has then gotten into public thinking. But anyway, that's just one, I guess, kind of small example of how it can go the other way. You know, legislation can influence the morality of the people that it legislates. Yeah. So,
and, you know, for a lot of people that are like familiar with Francis Schaeffer, for example, Francis Schaeffer, most people love Francis Schaeffer and the antithesis that he brings up, and kind of that not whether but which mentality. And yet that was part of Francis Schaeffer's thing was, I'm trying to remember the title of the book, but he wrote a book on essentially like the Christian obligation to, I don't want to say ecology or anything like that, or environmentalism. No, I think it was title. I think environmentalism was even in the title, but that was kind of part of his thing was like, how does the Christian respond to that? But then again, even Francis Schaeffer, I don't think he was really arguing much for a top-down legislative argument there. But it is, I mean, it's worth bringing up, though. Yeah, is it, like, does this impact the way we look at the government, for example, saying that gas stoves are evil and that we need to drive electric vehicles? Like, is that part of it? I would push back a little bit there and say that's more of an example of governmental, I don't want to just say overreach because that makes me sound like a, you know, news pundit or something like that. But you know what I mean? Like that sounds more like a government that's a bit too far reaching than it really sounds like a argument for or against theonomy. Because the whole argument behind theonomy is whose law will be enforced. I heard, I think it was, who said that? I don't remember who said it now, but you know, somebody asked him if he was a theonomist and he said, no, I hate God's law. You know, that was his kind of, you know, tongue in cheek response, but that's essentially the argument is, does God have a law? Is that law over all peoples, whether or not they recognize him or not, over all nations, whether they recognize him or not? And should we then, based on that, advocate that every nation bow the knee specifically, not to a God, but to Christ, and to honor his law word in their government and in their legislation and then in their statutes? That's just the general theonomy argument. Now you can push past that, and there's a whole lot of different kinds of theonomy. There's some guys that push it a bit far, like Rush Dooney and North and some of the, you know, they get labeled the Reconstructionists, who would argue for a lot more involvement maybe in the way that's worked out. There's others that would argue more for a general equity theonomy, which I quite like the sound of that, where you're arguing for the general equity of the law to be worked out. So in other words, we're not just trying to take Israel's law and just, you know, without thinking, just drop it into the American 2023 context. No, that would be nonsensical. But we're trying to take the general equity of the law that God has espoused in his word and then apply it to our current context. I think that makes a lot of practical sense for most Christians. But yeah, it's always the question of how then to reach that goal. But I think for a lot of Christians, and again, just kind of circling back a little bit, I think for a lot of Christians, the hurdle to get over is, number one, that there is not a division between Christ and state. We can talk about a division between church and state, even though there that line has been very blurred and those dynamics have been very convoluted.
Yes.
But we can talk about church and state relations. That's not what we're talking about with theonomy. With theonomy, we're talking about Christ and state. You can say God's law word should and must and does rule over every nation on this earth, and every king is called to bow the knee specifically to Christ. You can advocate for that without trying to say, oh, we want some sort of Protestant pope to reign over the nation state of America and execute heretics. Like that's different. That's a different sort of argument than just a general theonomic argument. But I think for most Christians, that's what we're talking about. Not theocracy, which would be kind of the ladder of how then would a state be run by Christians. We're talking about theonomy. Should God's law apply to the state? And theonomy is an important one, again, because if you don't have theonomos, which is theonomy, God, law, if you don't have theonomos, you have autonomos. If it's not God's law, it is man's law, and it will bring destruction. And if you're looking for an example, turn on the news on any given night and just see the things that are rolling out.
Yeah, I think what you said is very clear and very, very helpful to think about. But let me ask you this. Why, you mentioned at the very beginning that our society, well, Western society, but, you know, American society in general seems to be on a very steep decline morally, you know, away from God and his law, you know, everything. And it's not difficult to see. But why do you think that this, do you think that that is the reason, I should say, because maybe I've played my hand with the question, but like, do you think that that is the reason, because of this sharp moral decline, that theonomy and Christian nationalism, the talk of such, is on the rise? Because 10 years ago, I never really heard about it, not in a positive way or a negative way. And I can imagine that maybe in the, you know, the middle of the 20th century, people weren't necessarily talking about it in the same terms that we use today. I'm not going to say that the concept wasn't around, because obviously it has been around since, you know, God's law has been was given to the nation of Israel. But why is it that, why do you think maybe, or, you know, in your reading and in your discussion with other, because, you know, you've had a lot of opportunities to discuss with some of these prevalent voices recently, why do you think that this is such a big topic right now, and such a hot button issue? You know, it's a really divisive issue amongst a lot of people now. But why do you think that might be?
Yeah, number one, it is extremely divisive, and it's unfortunate that a lot of times, you know, not to downplay the fact that there's very real divisions, but a lot of times these things, people are shouting past each other a good bit, you know, on any given topic that tends to happen, and it's happening on this one. But I think for a lot of Christians, they're realizing that we're kind of coasting, and you could put the blame on why we're coasting on a lot of different things. I would point to kind of a radical pietism that has taken hold specifically within evangelical Christianity. And I can
define pietism. I know we've talked about pietism, but can you define what you mean by that?
I'll define that. Let me finish this one thought. So just, I think that a lot of Christians were realizing we're kind of coasting on the, and it's not even, for a while we were coasting on the benefits of having applied God's law in government and in legislation and in all forms. There was many good laws in this country that were reaping many good benefits for many people, whether they were Christian or not. We were reaping those benefits. And I think for a lot of Christians, we found ourselves coasting for a while. We're now kind of floating on the, I'll use my new favorite word from sermon prep, detritus. We're floating on essentially like the broken pieces of the wrecked ship, and we're floating up on the shore now, and we're looking around and saying, okay, we still have a couple of pieces of broken ship that we're drifting on, but this is not great. The ship has come apart. But how did these boards get built in the first place? I liked it better on the ship. I liked it better when we were sailing instead of floating up shipwrecked on the seashore. How do we put these boards back together, and who put them there in the first place, and what did they do? How do they get the plans together to put that ship together? I think that's where a lot of Christians are finding themselves right now. Going back to your other question though, with pietism, it's a term we've used a lot, and I know a lot of people will get upset at me using that term, because it sounds like kind of a way of caricaturizing the opposition, but I think it's an apt term. Pietism can be a good thing. Pietistic practices can be a good thing for the Christian. So like when we think of piety is a pursuit of the disciplines of the Christian life. It's a pursuit of living in a way that exemplifies godly virtues that are flowing out through your life. Piety is a good thing. Pietism is more of a removal of yourself from this world. So if you think of pietism, typically that's describing somebody that says the world will go the way of the world. However, we are on our holy hill. We will cloister here together. And essentially the things of this world do not concern the Christian. So a pietistic response to something like this would be to say it's unfortunate and wrong that they're passing bad laws, that they're calling what is good evil and what is evil good. Those are bad things. And yet really, we can't try to force any Christian laws through because that would just create nominalism. We can't really try to advocate for the state to turn from its bad ways because that would be political involvement. All we can do is pray that God converts individual souls and that those individual souls in the government or in the voting booth will do Christian things that may or may not result in Christian results. That's piety, and that's preached from a lot of pulpits right now within Christendom, and I think that is very, very misguided for a Christian response. And I think that's one reason why this debate is so hot, is because a lot of people are grappling with that. There are many Christians that, anyway, yeah, that's why it's so hot, is people grappling with that decision.
Well, yeah, because on one side you have someone who says God has given us the so-called Christian nationalists or theonomists who say, you know, God has given us clear direction and directives for how we must, like you say, become prophets, and to speak out against the evils and the ills of society and our nation's governance and the sinful direction it takes. And then on the other hand, you have those who say, am I mischaracterizing?
No, you're okay. Not mischaracterizing, but I just want to I want to make this part clear because this part this is something I've been thinking through. Maybe this will be helpful to the listener. So we used to talk about, and I can't remember the guy's name right now that made this illustration popular, but he would talk about what would it look like if Satan ran a country. And he said, you remember this illustration, right? Like the lawns would be cut, everybody would wear, buttoned up shirts that were tucked in and ironed, no one would cuss. Everybody would go to church on Sunday, they would pack the pews, and yet the gospel would not be preached. And kind of the impetus behind that is that it would be generally nice, except for the fact that nobody would actually be converted. And for a lot of Christians, we hear that and we think to ourselves, okay, so it's not good for something to look Christian or function Christianly if there's not actual heart conversion behind it. We would call that nominal Christianity or something like that. To an extent, that's right. So if you have a nation full of people that are acting as Christians, and yet there are no actual converted Christians within that nation, they're all going to be going to hell, right? Like they're not saved. It's not good. And yet, if we looked at that situation and said, here's a country, well, two things. Number one, you don't get nominal Christianity without true Christianity. So there's no nation out there that's just saying, hey, we're all going to act like Christians, but none of us actually believe or follow this God.
Yeah.
That's an overflow. And an unfortunate overflow, but an overflow of true Christianity. Wherever you find nominal Christianity, you're typically finding true Christians that are then that these other people are emulating in some form or fashion. But if we were to look at two nations, one of them has Christian values. They say murder is wrong, rape is wrong, incest is wrong. We want to prevent these things. We want to protect the ones who are victimized. We want to punish the wrongdoer. So they're in every way, they're acting Christianly and in accordance with God's law word, and yet they're not actually converted on the inside. You got that nation, and then next door you have another nation that says, you know what? We're going to mutilate our children. We're going to murder them in the womb. We're going to celebrate that which is evil. We're going to actively persecute and prosecute that which is good. We're going to fly pride flags from the church steeples. We're going to erect monuments to literally to Satan in the middle of the public square. We're going to call these things good. And you look at those two nations and say, which is better? It is obviously and of course better in the Christianized nation. And that's what I think a lot of Christians are trying to grapple with is, it does a soul no good whether they are converted or not. In other words, wait, let me rephrase that. It does a soul no good to not be converted, but to act Christianly, right? So if an individual soul, one person, is acting as a Christian and yet they're not truly converted, it does them no eternal good. We can accept that. However, if I live in a nation as a Christian with a Christian family, and my kids have laws that protect them from being mutilated, from being murdered, from being accosted in the public square, if we have those laws, is it better for me to live in a nation with Christian values, whether or not those politicians are truly regenerate and following Christ? Yes, and of course it's better. And I would also say it's obviously biblically better. There are many times in the Bible where we see a nation, even with a pagan king, that at least gives outward
Lip service.
Yeah, lip service conforms to the law word of God, and it blesses the nation because of that. God's laws bring blessing. Now, that's not to say, that king goes to heaven because if he's not regenerate, he's not going to go to heaven. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, does it benefit the state/culture/nation for them to observe God's law word, whether or not their leaders are actually regenerate? I think the answer is yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that's the position of the Christian nationalist or the theonomist. I mean, more the theonomist.
Big asterisk, because Christian nationalist, I'm just saying, brother, like there's some guys that are saying Christian nationalist that I'm not, I would be very cautious with what they're saying.
Okay, that's a fair disclaimer.
There's other guys that are saying, I mean, I heard it, like, for example, I'd encourage everybody, go listen to the Founders conference from this, what was that, in January, I think it was?
Yes.
And you've got guys like Vody Bakum, Tom Askell, and they're discussing these same issues. And if like Tom said, if that's Christian nationalism, sure, you can call me a Christian nationalist. But it's difficult when you've got other guys claiming that title and they're saying some very aberrant things.
Yes. So I mean, I appreciate the disclaimer. And I guess we shouldn't say the same thing toward the other side, in order to prevent making a straw man, the so-called pietists either. But what I was saying earlier is, on one side you have these people who all the things that you just said, who would say yes and amen, and on the other side you have people who would not necessarily disagree with the clear truths of what you just said and how scripture speaks to those things, but that they would say, because this is my issue, or this has been my issue, is what is my role to play then in these things? Because if we say that God himself is king, and we saw how Israel was punished for demanding that they had a leader like the pagan peoples, then should we not, is it not more pious? And of course I use that word for a reason, but is it not more pious to say, well, we're going to, let go of our control, and we're going to let God do his thing. I say that on purpose too, but, we're going to, the Lord is going to do what he wills. Society is going to do what they will. God is still their king, but let the nations rage, the pietist will say, let the nations rage, and God still rules over them with a rod of iron, and it doesn't matter what they do. And me and my family will worship the Lord, and these other pagans can do what they want to do. I'm not trying to minimize, I'm just trying to be brief. Because I realize that this is not just on either side, it's not flippant, but I feel that the more pietistic argument, the argument that rejects theonomy, that rejects so-called Christian nationalism, will say, is a more, they are themselves being flippant about this, because the reason why I feel this way is because I know for a long time I was being flippant, because I thought I was being more spiritual than the theonomist or the Christian nationalist by saying, well, I'll let God, that God will handle it in the end, or someone right. who says when asked about their eschatology, they'll say, well, I'm a pan millennialist, it'll all pan out in the end. Exactly. So all these kind of things. Sounds very pious, sounds very very much so like you're trusting in the Lord. And right. and I'm not saying that they don't. It just also right. is, you're not engaging in these topics as you must. Now, I do want to talk about, because this is something we talked about before we got on, this, when we talk about Christian nationalism, to my ignorant eyes, this seems like a uniquely, I know it's not, because I said in the beginning, it's, everyone is living under the influence of a nation, but this sometimes seems like a uniquely American problem or a uniquely American topic. I asked, like, why has this gotten so popular recently? And, you mentioned a bunch of things, the ship's going down, how can we right the ship? Or it's exploded, how can we put it back together? I would say probably most nations are not in the same place as the United States.
Right.
There's almost 200 countries, right? I don't want to be wrong. I think it's like 190 something. But there's I won't edit this out, just in case, so people know I'm super ignorant.
There's like 5,000 countries, Sean. There's like, yeah.
I think there's almost 200 countries in the world.
There we go.
And the United States is merely one of them. And mm-hmm. I know from living overseas for 2 years at this point that the United States does not have as much influence, thought influence, like into the way of, you know, the thinking of other cultures, as I previously thought that we did. And so most countries aren't going through the same thing.
Right.
Could you help me understand, maybe help listeners who are in other countries, how this issue of Christian nationalism affects more than just the United States? Because, I mean, we have defined it, Christian nationalism and theonomy, that it's God's law that works. But with a different government, I won't take France out of the equation, but let's say with a government that is in a government where it is illegal to be a Christian. Maybe, you know, you've got a Islamic theocracy, where it is illegal to be a Christian, or at the very best, if you are a Christian, you know, you have to go through all these Quranic laws and processes in order to exist in this society. How could someone exist with this theonomic theology? Yeah. How could someone exist? You know, how could someone have this opinion? I live right now in a, you were talking about smaller government kind of thing. I live in one of the countries in the world that has one of the biggest governments, you know, a horribly bloated government.
Right.
And I say horribly bloated, even the French people, there's a reason why you wait months and months and months to get a simple thing done here. It's just because everything is run by the government. Everything is government here. But the government has its hands in, we have a separation of church and state here too, but it's kind of the opposite of the United States version of separation of church and state. Yeah. How in these wildly different contexts, how can I, as a Christian, whether I'm in Iran or in France or in the United States, how can I, as a Christian, be a prophet in the, you know, to the powers that be in my nation? Like how does theonomy work for me?
So it's funny because as you were describing that, I was thinking back to COVID, not to bring up another controversial thing, but like during COVID, a lot of churches include, I'll put myself in this bag, not as a church, but, you know, as one of the leaders in a church, a lot of churches were confronted by governmental requests and sometimes governmental demands, depending on where you lived, we hadn't built the framework yet, right? Like, so that the rain was falling, we knew we needed to get a tarp up over the roof, and yet the frame of the house, we weren't still exactly how we wanted to build it, or at least the parts that we hadn't really thought through. So with anything like this, the how do you do it, to me, is the second step, or maybe even third step past, like we talked earlier about, what are we aiming to do? So for Christians, for example, if we're agreeing on these things and we're moving toward these things, and you live in, you know, Saudi Arabia and you live in Mecca, and you know, you have the First Baptist Church of Mecca that meets in your, I'm assuming, you know, basement, so you can avoid persecution or something like that. It's probably not practical, nor probably is it wise and being a good steward for you to march into the local city council and demand that they destroy all their mosques and that they honor Christ as Lord and that they pass laws in accordance with God's law word. Like, that's probably, you know, it's just that would be a bit nonsensical for you.
Right.
So like, depending on where we are, and I think we're going to start to get there in American culture, it doesn't mean we are silent when we must proclaim truth. It certainly doesn't mean that we accept untruth as truth. Those are the times at which we always have to stand and say, no, I can't confess these things, and I must tell you what's true and what is right. But it does mean that we're maybe a little bit strategic in the way we go about those things when it is practical, right? Like when we can be strategic biblically, we want to be strategic in order to advance those things. But it's about where we're coming from on the front end. So I think for a lot of Christians, what they're grappling with right now is when Christ taught us to pray in the model prayer, you know, the Lord's Prayer is John 17, model prayer is Matthew 6. And Christ says, pray like this. And he teaches us to pray, your kingdom come, your will be done, which when you hear his will, you can think of his law, because that is the expression of his will. And we're called to pray for those things on earth as it is in heaven. So for me, that would be step one for a lot of Christians, is saying, okay, so God's law word expressed and his kingdom coming and expanding is not just something that takes place within our hearts. It's something we should expect to take place in this world. In other words, there should be an experienced application of Christ's kingdom expanding, because that is how Christ has taught us to pray. And that's just one example. But okay, so we put that to the side, and then we say, is there a good expression of that in the laws and in the governance of people, even from secular spheres. So, for example, are murder laws, or laws against murder, rather, are those good things? Yes, they're good. Why are they good? Because God's law reflects these things, and they reflect God's law, and we will be blessed. We will live better lives. The nation will be blessed. My family will be blessed. There will be blessings that come from that. If we can establish that kind of framework toward an actual lived experience and an actual applied governance then by God's law word in this world, if we get that framework, then we can walk through the how-tos. The how-tos at that point become just kind of okay, now that we've established the framework of the house, where do we put the tarp and how do we nail it down, that type of thing. But I think for a lot of Christians, we need to establish that framework first and foremost. Is that going to look different in Saudi Arabia than it does in Mississippi? Probably. But we need to establish the framework first, because for a lot of Christians, I don't think we've worked through that.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, that's not debatable. This is something that I think that, you know, when I asked earlier, like, why is it such a hot topic now? I could imagine we always have to give this disclaimer at the beginning that, like, you might not have heard of this, but it's really a big deal. Kind of for most Christians, I don't think that they're thinking about this kind of thing. You know, most Christians in the States are lamenting the direction the government's heading, but then their only response to it is, well, this singular character who seems to be the sole governor of our country needs to be voted out and replaced with another singular character, and that'll solve the problem. You right. know, we're always putting Band-Aids over issues rather than seeing the greater whole. So I appreciate even thinking about this together on the podcast, because it's not something that, you know, it really has extended this far into Europe. You know, I mean, and I can only imagine what people in Eastern countries or in Middle Eastern countries or in, you know, African countries are thinking about when they hear the terms Christian nationalism, because it really does seem like on the outset, because it's mostly American authors who are speaking about it, that it's a uniquely American issue. And it's not. It's an issue for those who live in Thailand, as it is for those who live in Burkina Faso and, you know, for Saudi Arabia, like you said. It's because we all live under, one, ultimately, the authority of the Lord, and he has put into place earthly kings and earthly rulers.
Right.
You know, and he again, ultimately will bring them all to heel. But it's just, how do we live? So we have the same scripture. We believe the same scripture as Christians. And we know these things are true. But how then does it play out? What's our role in these things? These are all very tricky things to think about.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to, because me personally, I'm still, and you are too. I mean, evidently, or not evidently, but obviously, we're all in a place where we are learning about all these things. We have to all react to the information that we're given in the unique time and social milieu that we find ourselves in. So we're all going to develop opinions differently on these things. And I would say, I know that I have very strong opinions about this topic, and I know that you do too. But I think that it's good that we still remain charitable to those who don't necessarily follow the same line of thinking as we do.
I would say this, Sean, and because we've said a lot, excuse me, and I don't want to belabor the point, but I would say this. I think for Christians, it would be a massive victory if we could dispel the myth of neutrality from our thinking. The fact that we would say that if there's not a Christian voice or value or morality, that it will just be kind of a neutral state into which, or, and I don't mean state in the sense of government, but like the idea that like Christianity can be removed from a sphere, and that sphere, in wherever it might be, will remain in some sort of neutral, unaffected state. That's a myth. Because there will always be something. It's never a matter of whether there will be a morality. It's always a matter of which morality. It's never a matter of whether morality will be legislated. It's always a matter of which morality will be legislated. So if Christians could just dispel ourselves of that myth of neutrality and understand that if God is not being recognized as king, then something is being recognized as king that is not God and that is antithetical to God because it's being recognized as king. If we can get that into our heads, I think that will help frame a lot of our thinking.
Yes, that's very helpful to think about. You know, I guess just to kind of round this discussion out, one thing that I don't want to see from my brothers and sisters that are still or in the States is what it seems to me is happening is that eventually the Christian church in the United States will be much like it is in Canada, you know, where we've seen it's kind of just relegated to some sort of antiquated institution that, you know, if it stays in its lane, it's not going to, you know, get too bad of a spanking. But then, you know, during COVID, we saw a great many, you know, pastors jailed and for disregarding COVID procedures and things like that. But in France and in Western Europe, you know, kind of the Protestant church is in such a minority that everyone here seems to be just kind of keeping their heads down, you know, trying not to raise a too bad of a ruckus. So when you talk about, you know, being kind of modern day prophets and speaking out against the not injustices of the government or the ruling authorities, but I mean the in God's eyes, the injustices of the government and ruling authorities, that's not even really a concept here. It's almost seen as kind of, you know, that typical American independence and rebellion, you know, that this kind of, you know, fierce, willing to fight about anything mentality that most of the world sees America as having. When I've spoken to some European brothers over here, some pastor friends of mine, and asked them what their, you know, if they've been reading anything on Christian nationalism or theonomy or their, like what their opinions are on it, I had to, they were not familiar with it. I mean, they're on the same Twitter, but the world is light years away. I mean, to think about there being a church in, or you know, a church movement in Italy or in France or in Spain that would say something contrary to the government. You know, when we have prayer meetings here, and you know, I agree, but when with the prayers of my brothers and sisters, but when we have prayer meetings here, so many people they thank God for the ability to even practice our faith here. Wow. in secular society. And, you know, they're, and that's where they're, it seems like most people are comfortable being is right. They let us be Christians here. So let's just not, you know, we're not going to be football hooligans about it. And we're not going to, you know, thump our Bibles too hard. We'll stay low. We'll obey the rules. I mean, there's even a whole institution in France that kind of is for representing us weird Protestants to the government because we're such a small minority. And there's been a recent legislation that is contrary to the Protestant church. And instead of this organization drafting some sort of statement to the government decrying this new legislation that is against Protestantism and against just the religious people in general, they have instead just focused all their attention on teaching Christians how to work with this new restrictive legislation. I mean, there's like no thought at all to, you know, how us Christians should be representatives of the King of Kings. You know, right. we just sort of exist as, you know, rats on a sinking ship, and it's disheartening sometimes. It's interesting at other times, you know, from kind of an outsider's perspective, but it's something I would hate for my friends in the United States to kind of go down the path of let's just stay low, keep our heads down. Oh, they're going to make, you know, we'll quiet. And I'm an advocate for homeschool, but what I see often is instead of speaking out against the degradation of public education and against, you know, no one's speak or relatively few are speaking against it, and they're just removing their children from it without saying anything, you know, right. just trying to just stay out of the way of the Indiana Jones giant boulder, you know, rolling down the cave rather than, you know, standing in the gap. So
and maybe next time we could make that part of our topic is the world seemingly spiraling and what does that actually look like in the eschatological grand scheme. That would be a fun one to walk through. But yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Fun. In giant quotation marks. Okay, good. Well, I honestly, I really appreciated the way that you have kind of succinctly summarized some of these things. If anyone has any questions about some of the topics that we've discussed or some of the vocabulary that we've used in this episode, you can always email us, gooddoctrinepodcast@gmail.com.
Yep.
We both get those emails. If there's anything else, Josh, you can tell us?
Nope. I think that'll pretty much do it for me. So yeah.
Well, let me ask first, is there any recommended reading you have on the topic? I mean, cause you've mentioned some books, but is there any person that you would recommend?
Specifically on government, I would definitely recommend a guy named Joe Boot or Joseph Boot. He's written a couple of things. He has an institute called the Ezra Institute. So you can look him up there, check out his books. He's got some really good thinking on this. I'd recommend some things by Greg Bahnsen in this regard. A lot of the reformers dealt with similar issues to this, but a lot of times it may be easier for some modern readers to kind of bridge that gap by hitting some contemporary readers and then working backwards. So yeah, Joe Boot, Greg Bahnsen. You can read Gary North, although I don't agree with all of Gary North's conclusions. He's got some compelling kind of structural analysis thereof. Some modern political voices. Again, I recommended Tymon Klein, and there's a few others there. You can keep up with Jared Longshore if you're into popular media. Jared Longshore speaks on a lot of these issues, as does Toby Sumter. Both of them are out in Moscow, Idaho, but both of them are pretty measured in their approach. And yet, like I said, it's kind of popular level, so they're more on YouTube and things like that. But that would be some good starting points, I would think.
The most formative reading for me personally was actually the prologue to Calvin's Institutes, where he writes to the King of France, and this is, you know, the prelude to the Huguenot, like the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre. So anyway, it's interesting reading. It's very helpful to think about, I think. But yeah, that's it for me.
Yo, I could throw in Abraham Kuyper's 3-volume set. That would be really formative if you can bite off that chunk. But yeah, touch base with us, Facebook group, gooddoctorpodcast@gmail.com. Join us next time. And in the meantime, we will continue to pray that your good doctrine will establish good living.